All right, and welcome back to another episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast with DSI. I'm Giles Sutton, and joining us today is the legendary Dan Green, who's principal of Blackbriar Development. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dan.
Appreciate you inviting me in, man. Legendary, I love that.
The legendary, right? And I have to say, you know, for those that are watching on YouTube, we have the Union Jack British flag here as well. We're representing. Today is a Brit takeover of the Rebuilding the Palisades podcast. So, speaking of which, Dan, tell us a little bit of how you got started in the business and what brought you out to LA.
Well, you know, like everything, I always say, like, when you move to a new country, there's always a good woman behind it, right? Yeah. You know, you never move somewhere without real motivation, and motivation is a woman. I fell in love. So my wife, I met her in Bali, and we were living in England, and she was like, it's too cold. We need to move. She's like, either you find a job in Asia or America, or I'm leaving. And I was like, oh shit, I better sort something out, right? So I was working for a company in the UK called Gardner & Theobald that are quite big here in LA as well. They do a lot of work here in LA, and so they transferred me out from the London office to the LA office, and I worked in Beverly Hills for about 6 years in their office, and then from there started my own firm. I started my own firm when I was 29, so
awesome.
It's been a while.
So what lessons did you learn along the way, would you say, getting to sort of what shaped your entrepreneurial path here?
Well, for me, you know, I was very much originally on the owner's rep side, so I was representing a lot of owners. So I've always looked at things very much from an owner's perspective, right? Like how do we help them? How do we make sure that they're taken care of? How do we see things from their perspective? So working on the owner's rep side for 6 years before I kind of came back to being a builder, because my grassroots was as a builder, really. That's always what I wanted to do, was get back to building and helping people build houses, you know, build high-end homes. So, you know, once I kind of found my feet on the owner's rep side, and then I started to kind of project manage some bigger homes for people where I was representing them representing them when they were working with other contractors. So I was kind of overseeing those contractors, because we, you know, as an owner's rep, you oversee things soup to nuts, right? You oversee the entire process. So from there, you know, I started to get into a situation where I was like asking my clients, hey, well, maybe I could build one of these houses for you, right? Maybe I could move from being an owner's rep to being a builder. I had the experience, I had the ability to do it. So it was just like, okay, when do you get that first chance to do it, right? And you start with something small and you work your way up, right? So you start with a 1,500 square foot house and you say, hey, I can build that. And then, you know, you build from there, and slowly you go bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, the houses get bigger and the houses get more complicated and the clients become more sophisticated and, you know, things get tougher. But you always have to take that next step, right, in terms of evolving yourself and figuring out how to do something bigger. I always like to say, you know, to a certain extent, you get the job first, then figure out how you're going to do it, right? It's always the case. Everybody has to do something once first, right? You've always got to do it first. It may be that it's a little bit bigger than what you've done before, but you have the skills, right? You've proven it. It's just a little bit bigger and a little bit more complicated than it was last time, but you've already proven that you could do something on a smaller scale, and you work your way up. So I think that's the process that I went through to arrive at kind of now building like 40,000 square foot homes, right? That makes sense?
Absolutely. I mean, you say, you know, the complexities. I think that's an interesting thing to sort of look at now. I mean, in terms of, I think your company is very much known for handling a lot of like complex builds, hillsides, subterranean basements, huge skylights, cantilever structures. Which of these architectural or engineering challenges have you found sort of most rewarding to tackle, and how does solving those problems influence your vision for what's possible in design?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think one thing that I'm finding as a builder working with other designers, interior designers, architects, is that the level of information that's being provided by the interior designer or the architect is not necessarily getting better, right? and so there's more onerous on the builder to help them engineer and figure out how to transition their drawings from maybe a design development set into, you know, workable drawings. So I think there's a lot of fun and enjoyment that we get out of really kind of helping them take it to that next step, because sometimes it's that early integration of a fabricator that allows the architect or interior designer to understand, well, this is probably not the first time that this has been done, right? And there's a specialist that already exists in the trades that's already doing or engineering something similar to what they want to do. So the rather than them trying to kind of engineer everything down to the nuts and bolts, doesn't always make sense, right? It's like, let's figure out how are we integrating in specialist vendors to be able to kind of figure out how we're going to build this thing, because it's probably been done before or something similar has been done before. And so I think there's a really big responsibility on us to do, you know, these, what we like to say, constructability reviews, right? Figure out how do we build something this complicated and help them engineer it. So it's really a collaborative process that it becomes. And so I really get a lot of enjoyment out of that, out of figuring out things, you know, with architects, with interior designers, and really figuring out who's the right solution for them in terms of a vendor to bring them in to help. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's, are you speaking almost like a design build methodology, that kind of...
Well, it's funny because I like to call it design assist,
right?
Not design build. And there's a clear delineation between the two. They're not the same thing. A design build contractor really kind of doesn't have an architect or interior designer involved. They are the interior designer and architect. For us, we don't really do that. We don't say that we do design. We say we do design assist. So we take the vision of an interior designer architect and help them develop that into workable drawings from sort of like a DD level.
That's pretty unique, I would say, right? I've not sort of heard of that so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's probably much more common in Europe than it is in the US. Like, a lot of the processes and procedures of European ways of doing things, they typically kind of only take a sort of set of drawings to that DD level, and then the builder's starting to come in and engineer it at the CD level in Europe anyway. So I think that it's kind of, it just makes sense, right? It just makes sense that that's the way things are going. So what that means is that the need to bring on a builder for pre-construction services is much more apparent, right? It's like, okay, why do we want to go too far down the road engineering something that we might have to come back and re-engineer with our architect, with our builder? Rather, let's bring him on early and go through that process together. Mm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, just touching on that a little bit more, actually. Have you ever worked on construction projects in the UK, in Europe as well?
Yeah.
You have done. And so yeah. What would you say the main sort of differences between the sort of construction process? I think, you know, this is the first time we've had a Brit on this podcast. Mm. And, you know, while we've got the flag right there.
The flag,
the
baby.
The flag. It's fine. There it is. So I think, you know, I think our listeners would be interested to hear, you know, are there things that you've brought from your experience of working in the UK or in Europe as well to the US or vice versa? Where have you seen some differences, and how's that really benefited you in your role here?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few, but it's funny, you do tend to see quite a lot of sort of British trained professionals in the construction space here in LA. It's surprising how many there are, actually. Specifically, I would say there's quite a lot of construction managers on the owner's rep side, right? There's the Gardner and Theobalds of the world, but there's other companies that have kind of branched off, and British guys that I know that like are doing kind of owner's rep services here. And I think the big difference that I see is kind of like that QS mentality. When I say QS mentality, it's called quantity surveying, right? So it's like they're looking at things a bit different when it comes to estimating and figuring out how to price something, because they're really breaking it down in a very different way. So it allows you to really understand exactly where is the money being spent to build a house.
It controls the flow of money.
Yeah, it controls the flow of money. There's more detail as it relates to specification of what is being priced. So the pricing is more detailed in terms of scope of work that are written. And then I think, you know, back to what I said earlier, really, that sort of that design, sort of build, design assist mentality is also something that, you know, I think comes a little bit from the UK. I think, you know, the construction methods as well, you know, certain things that we do here in the US, a little prehistoric in certain, to a certain extent. There's old ways of doing things that we continue to just keep doing them. And we didn't reinvent, like, some of those things. It's starting to happen, but, like, whether that be prefabrication, whether that be ways that we're doing we're using concrete in very old-fashioned ways. So, you know, this seems like the construction industry is a little bit slow to adopt new technology sometimes, but I think that that's changing. You know, I think it's changing.
I always think it's interesting. One of the things I've sort of noticed, one of the most stark differences, is there's so much timber, you know, the stud construction rather than concrete. I know you just touched on it just then. It's that everything in the UK is sort of steel work, concrete. You know, I guess in terms of like what we're talking about here with palisades rebuild and building for resilience, do you feel like that plays any particular role in, you know, the construction methodologies, the construction materials that are being used?
Well, it's funny. It reminds me of a recent story, which is interesting, because typically what we have seen is that whenever we've priced like a light gauge steel structure in lieu of a wood structure, it's always been more expensive, right? Because it generally is, the material is more expensive, right? But interestingly, we priced a 10,000 square foot house recently. Wasn't actually in the Palisades, but it was Palisades adjacent. It's in the same area. And there's a 10,000 square foot house. We priced it with wood framing. The drawing showed wood framing. And it was $1 million, which is really high for wood framing for 10,000 square foot. It's very high. It should be closer to sort of 60 bucks a foot, maybe a little bit less right now is what we're seeing. But this was, you know, a lot more than that. We thought this was strange. This is, why is it coming in so much? We tried to kind of work with our subcontractor to understand the numbers, and I think that there was a lot of kind of, I think they were scared a little bit, right? They're worried about the market, they're worried that things were going to go up, they're worried about the tariffs, I don't know, there was this worry there, and sometimes that means people price things high, or maybe they were just super busy, I don't know, but we decided to go and look at some alternate options. So what we did was we worked with this company out of Arizona that does light gauge metal framing. And they re-engineered the entire set of plans that we had that were in wood framing to be light gauge steel. And they priced it out. And their pricing, just for the material, was $250,000. Right? We priced the labor, which is faster, goes up way quicker, easier. And our pricing for the labor was another $250,000. So it was $500,000 compared to $1 million in wood framing for this house.
Yeah.
So why? Well, first of all of the light gauge metal framing is being done off-site. It's in Arizona. Labor costs are significantly less there. So it took a lot of kind of that labor, you know, that we would have done in LA and took it off-site. And I think that's a main driving factor, I'm telling you. I mean, the labor costs here are just super expensive. So it was interesting to see that for the first time, I'm seeing light gauge metal framing may be cheaper. And I think, obviously, that's much more resilient to fire. So we're starting to do that. We're starting to see plans that we're actually able to just re-engineer to light gauge metal framing. Not only is it saving money there, we're actually able to remove some of the structural steel as well, because now the light gauge steel is actually stronger and can support, you know, some of the framing that, you know, now we can eliminate some of that steel. So I thought that was a really interesting, you know, thing to note, that like that's starting to happen. And I think there's a lot of people that might be interested in rebuilding their house in steel or concrete, but in steel, which is just an equivalent to wood in a way, right? Because the framing members are the same size, if not smaller. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought, oh, it's really interesting, you know, anecdote that's what's happening in the market right now.
Discover why we're the most awarded home technology firm in the U.S. Our design-centric approach transforms your space with effortless control of lighting, motorized shades, audio, video, and more. Our friendly experts guide you every step of the way, no tech speak, just smart, stunning simplicity. We provide years of care from our award-winning service and support team. Experience technology that feels as good as it looks.
On that, in terms of looking at the, I mean, certainly from a from the technology integrator world, looking at the UK and the US, significantly easier to, you know, pull cables through stud walls than it is in the UK, which is like, you know, you've got brick and, you know, and slab and things like that. But what, you know, thinking about technology, what sort of emerging technologies have you guys, you know, employed in some of your developments and seen, you know, like, you know, whether there's been swimming pools or, you know, smart home? I'm kind of curious to see what role of technology you see in your builds.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge role, right? I mean, it's a huge role. I mean, you probably can answer that question better than I can because you're a tech guy, right? So you probably, you'll be like, yeah, Dan, what are you talking about? Like, this is actually what's happening. It's really a question that you should probably answer. But, the you know, there's so much new tech coming out all the time, right? So, and we're always trying to, like, figure out how to introduce that into homes that we're building, whether that be on the spec side, because we build spec developments as well. We don't just build for end users. We'll raise our own capital, we'll put our own money into deals, and we'll build for ourselves. So, you know, if we're building as a spec development, we're always looking at what new technologies can we integrate into the house to make it work seamlessly, right? Mm. Which is, you know, the typical, you know, home integration systems that we see unit used is either going to be Questron, Control 4, or Savant. Those are the main three that we use. We typically end up using Savant more than anything else, but we also just find, like, depends on the AV integrator that we're working with, because some just have a preference, right? Some, like, they love to use Savant, they love to use Questron. So those home automation things. But, you know, there's other cool sort of technologies as it relates to, you know, climate control. Lighting is, like, huge, right? In terms of just, like, scene adjusted lighting that adjusts to, you know, the sun's position and this kind of stuff. Wellness is very big right now, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, how do we create wellness in the home, right? That is the same as wellness when you go to the wellness center, right? It's like, we want to be well at home. That means, you know, HEPA filters for HVAC, because, you know, everyone's very worried about particles in LA, you know, the fires, everything's been going on, right? They want to make sure that when they're home, they're safe, the air is of good quality, the water is really of good quality, right? Water is a huge one, whole house filtration systems, and just any kind of new technologies that we can integrate, we try to, you know?
I've certainly noticed that there's sort of more of a distrust of some of the infrastructure here than there is in the UK as well, actually. So you're talking about, there seems to be almost a desire to have some self-sufficiency from homes, whether that's, as you say, like having, you know, taking responsibility for clean air, clean water, even maybe power management as well, like, because, you know, demands on the electricity infrastructure and stuff here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, all these big houses have a generator of sometimes, so sort of backup power. You know, whether it be, you know, a battery backup power from solar, we're often seeing that, as well as a backup generator that's just probably diesel, you know, like just down and dirty diesel generator, in addition to, you know, a backup power that can be solar powered, so that they can kind of keep a portion of the house on, right? If they have a large home, maybe it's not they don't get the whole house, they might get, you know, the kitchen and, you know, the main systems can stay online, right?
So you mentioned actually just that you have these sort of two parts to your organization. You have the sort of contracting side and then, you know, you do the spec homes, the development side as well. How does wearing those two hats, I mean, you from your experience of being, you know, client rep, you know, how do you sort of manage those two different, those two different needs? So one which has a client, one which doesn't have a client.
Yeah.
You know, how do you sort of, what sort of unique insights do you, can you share on those two sort of hats you have to wear?
Well, I think it's cool because, you know, as a developer, we're always looking at how we can do things more efficiently, right? Like, how do we, and a lot of that comes down to sourcing, right? So we're always looking at, where are we sourcing materials? How are we building stuff off-site? How are we removing some of the labor expense from LA and taking it away from LA, right? So that could mean, you know, we have a house right now that we just finished. We imported the entire house from Indonesia. The entire house was imported in Indonesia, all the cabinetry, all the doors, everything, all the siding, the whole house was, right?
Incredible.
Because the whole house was teak and the availability of sourcing for that material was there. So we went there to get it and we fabricated it there because it made sense. But if the whole house was, you know, another material like oak, it wouldn't have made sense to go to Indonesia because oak is an available material that you would source in America, right? But we might then go, okay, well, how are we fabricating outside of LA, right? If we're, as a spec developer, does that mean is there other places in the US that make more sense to fabricate and save money? And so what I'm saying is when we're looking at things that way, it helps because then when we look at things for our clients, we can say, okay, well, we have this source or we have this way of doing things that we've done as spec developers that we can pass on those savings to you. Whether that be direct sourcing stone from a quarry in Italy that we already have the connection with when they want to get their own slabs, right? We can do that, right? Whether that be going to Mexico and sourcing certain things, you know, which is adjacent to LA and has a huge amount of resources and the ability to get things cheaper. So it's not always, listen, we want to keep things in America as much as we can, but it's not always, you know, one size fits all. There's plenty of things in the house that are going to be sourced from America. So if we go outside to source some things as well in order to reduce cost and be more efficient, then that's okay. And I think that's really the benefit that I get is like, I'm always putting my developer cap on for clients saying, how can I save you money? Or just do things more efficiently. Cause it's not about necessarily saving money. It's about making sure that the money goes as far as it can. And if it means if we save money in prefabricating X, Y, and Z, it means that that money that we saved, we can put into something else in the house to really elevate the finishes and they can spend it somewhere else, right? What does that mean? It means that they get a better quality house, right? That's of more high end for less money. And I get a house that's built that's also of better quality that I can showcase, right? Or I can show people we did this together, right? We achieved this together. So I think that's really the benefit, right, of wearing both hats.
With how developers have been sort of viewed in terms of the Palisades, and there's been a little bit of maybe a little bit of sort of negative about, you know, developers. Negativity about developers coming in, buying up lots, driving up prices, displacing, you know, homeowners, and the concerns sort of the character of the neighborhood. Curious to hear your thoughts on that, in terms of, you know, how you sort of approaching, I don't know if you are working on any of the, or looking at lots in the Palisades at the moment. I mean, you know, again, coming from London, there's a huge development market in London and, you know, there are developers that build with very, very high specs.
Yeah.
There are also developers that cut a lot of corners. So I'm curious to hear your sort of counter to some of those sort of concerns.
Well, I mean, listen, it's tough, right? It's tough for everybody, right? Like, you know, nobody wanted this amount of houses to burn down. And I think that there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there that, like, you know, that this was, you know, like, oh yeah, that there's going to be this, we're creating this tech, you know, this new age, you know, city, right? But the reality, like, and that's going to be ready before the Olympics. It's like, that's not going to happen, right? It's like those houses aren't going to be all rebuilt by then, I don't think. And I don't think that anybody with the right mind thinks that, you know, this was intentional by any means, like it was an accident. Could it have been prevented if things were done differently? Sure, I truly believe that if the right protections were put in place, it could have been potentially prevented. But it happened, right? So it happened and now we got to deal with it, right? And so I think that there's a lot of different people in a lot of different situations, right? And so If you're a 85-year-old man or husband and wife that lived in the Palisades, you know, maybe you don't want to move back, right? Maybe you want to, you know, move closer to your kids or something else makes more sense, right? So in that regard, then, you know, you would want to sell your lot probably, right? And so if you want to sell your lot and somebody can come in and buy it for a fair price, right? then that should be allowed to happen and should not be frowned at, right? So if that means that a young couple can come and buy it or a developer can come and buy it, I think that that's okay, right? And so what happens when a developer comes in and buys it? They're going to develop the land, right? They're going to build a house anyway, and then they're going to sell it, and somebody else is going to buy it, right? And so ultimately, another family is going to move back there to that piece of property, right? So I think that's okay, right? So I think that obviously that's not everybody's situation, right? Some people want to rebuild, and they should. Hopefully, as many people rebuild and move back as possible. But it's not a one-size-fits-all solution, right? Everybody has their own personal situation. And there's a lot of people also that's like, well, you know, I have family. My kids are, you know, let's just say you've got kids that are like, you know, maybe starting middle school, right? Your kids are starting middle school when this happened. By the time you get back, they're going to be ready for high school. So it's like, does it make sense for them as well, right? So there's a lot of different situations like that. A lot of it is also depending on your kids and their situation. So, but ultimately, I think that what's important is that we try to make sure that everybody can maximize, you know, the value of their lot, and whether or not they're rebuilding themselves for themselves, or they're rebuilding to sell to somebody else, or they're selling to a developer, they get the most that they can out of the situation because they've been through so much, right? And they deserve that. They deserve to get the most out of the situation that they can. So for us, what we want to try to do is just help as many people as possible, right? Whether that be of giving them advice about, you know, what we think they can be done, how much it's going to cost. And we're running pro formas for people all the time, right? That look at what's it really going to cost to rebuild, how much are they getting out of insurance, helping them maximize the amount that they can get out of insurance. So really, they can just maximize what they get out of the lot, right? Whatever the situation is, whether they want to move back, they want to rebuild and sell, or they want to just sell the land, or they want to rebuild and move back, right? I think those all the different situations are different, and I think that we just as professionals have a responsibility to try to help as many people as we can in the situation that they're in. And, you know, hopefully, you know, most of those are people that want to go back and be back in the community. And we've seen that a lot of people that do, you know, a lot of people do want to get back to the community, you know.
What advice would you be giving if someone was coming to you right now? I know that, you know, I think there's only been about a quarter of permits that have been issued, you know, for homeowners at the moment. I think there seems to be a kind of a sort of delay in some respects, a pause maybe. What advice would you give to a homeowner right now? You know, is there a risk there's going to be some empty lots that are going to be held for some time, do you think? Or would you say, full guns blazing, get going right now? Just looking at all the other sort of the sort of broader construction industry as well, some of the things that are happening right now. Is now a good time to start a rebuild, I guess, is the question.
Well, I mean, I think that if you compare the situation to having an empty lot before the fires happened, the city have given you some advantages, right? So if you understand that and you're a homeowner that has a lot, maybe you've been cleared by the Army Corps of Engineering or you did it privately, I think it makes sense for people to go through the permitting process to get their lots permitted, right? So, because that's adding value, right? Ultimately, if they can, you know, rebuild, I think that they should, regardless of whether they sell at the end of that process or not. So I think, you know, hiring an architect, getting through the design process as quickly as you can is a good thing. And I think that hiring a contractor to help you in that pre-construction planning process is really good as well. And further, I would say that, like, there's going to be a point at some point in the future, I'm not sure when any of us know when it is, where things are going to get crazy, right? It's going to get busy. You're going to have contractors stacked on top of themselves. I'm assuming, right? I don't know that for sure, but I'm assuming that at some point it's going to get really busy. And what that means is that the entire industry is going to be stretched, right? Which means that labor is going to be stretched, the contracts are going to be stretched, and that means that prices ultimately, just by the nature of it, will tend to rise, right? So with that in mind, if I was a homeowner, I would probably choose to get a contractor on board early. I would work with one contractor as opposed to trying to price it out to five different ones, right? And then work with them on a way where there's an open book policy. You're working together to figure out how much this house is going to cost. And you're looking at everything with them, right? Every single subcontractor bid and understanding exactly what it's going to cost and having them be, you know, a fiduciary for you and looking after your interest so you can rebuild as quickly as possible. I mean, that's the advice that I would give homeowners is, like, you know, start the process early and get a contractor on board early, because at some point you're going to be kind of like the group that's left behind, right? And then they're going to get deprioritized is what I'm assuming, right? And they're going to be like fishing to try to find somebody and they can't, right? So I think if you can, like anything, urgency is best. And I will also say that moving forward with rebuilding in the Palisades, if you do it, it's only going to push other people to do it as well. And right. What do we all want? We want the community to be rebuilt as quickly as possible. Get back to where we were. So the faster you do it, the faster your neighbor's going to do it, and everybody else is going to do it, and we're going to start to see things get rebuilt. So I think that that's, you know, it's like, you know, being a leader in that process is going to help others, you know, fall behind you.
That makes a lot of sense. The almost sooner rather than later. And actually, I think you touched on, a really interesting and important point, is that actually, you know, there is a potential point in the future where we're going to see a construction boom here. And that's going to put enormous pressure on the labor that we have currently. It's funny, I was actually talking to an Uber driver last night who said he's not normally an Uber driver, but actually, you know, this is part-time, and he's going to LA Trade and Technical College and doing his electrical contracting.
Oh, yeah.
I said, yes, we need more of you.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, there's a boom coming.
Yeah, there's no tradesmen.
Do you think that's, are you seeing anyone sort of really preparing for that at the moment? I'm not necessarily seeing it myself, but...
Yeah, I mean... Preparing for it is a tough word, right? It's like, how do you prepare for it? I think that what happens is, the reality is that when you can't find the labor, you'll start to then look for where you're going to find it, right? But until you can't find the labor that you need, it's going to be very much a reactionary thing, I think. I mean, we're going to try to prepare for it as much as we can. Actually, we own a separate labor company, so we do a lot of work in-house. So we have a company called OnTap Trade, and we provide labor. So our labor business is where we're preparing for it by increasing that, increasing our pool of labor that we have inside of OnTap Trade, and we actually rent labor. So we rent labor to other contractors. So what we're gearing up for is that, like, when other contractors need labor, we can help them, right? And we can provide that labor to them. And so where would we be sourcing that additional labor from when we need it the most? It's probably out of state. It's probably going to come from Texas. It's probably going to come from other states that, you know, maybe can bring it here temporarily for a period of time. You know, I think that it's going to be supplementing some of the subcontractors with additional guys for a period of time when they need it, right? And they're stretched. So maybe a plumber needs a few extra guys, or an electrician needs a few extra guys on a project-by-project basis. What our goal is to try to help them infill a little bit of that labor through OnTap Trade for our labor company, but also then be able to control the labor on our own projects because we do a lot of stuff in-house.
So there could be a ripple effect from the Palisades, not because you were talking about Texas, from other, you know, other states. There could be, I mean, with everything, you know, already, let's be honest, the trades, I think the statistics, like, for every three that leave the skilled trades or retire, there's only one coming in. That ripple effect could affect labor costs or home building costs across the United States with what's happening in the Palisades, with so many having to be built potentially.
I mean, it could. Yeah, we don't know yet. We don't know how kind of crazy it's going to get, whether this kind of curve of construction is going to go like this, like an S curve, or if it's just going to kind of, you know, be a slow and steady kind of pace. You know, it really depends on how many people kind of jump on the bandwagon and how many of these permits get issued and how much layering there is. But ultimately, yeah, it could definitely affect, you know, other markets where we need to pull labor from other markets to be able to supplement what's going on here. I think so.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I think if anything, it sort of hammers home a little bit, you know, what you're saying about sooner rather than later. I think it's like it's better to kind of get something going right now.
Yeah.
And then that will, before things start to get a little bit crazier.
Even if you're on the fence about whether or not you're actually going to rebuild, for me, it makes sense to at least re-permit.
Yeah.
Right? So you're sitting there with a permit ready to go. Now you're in a stronger position anyway, right? Because you can say, okay, I've got a permit set of plans that's ready to build. I can still decide to sell the lot, right, if I want to. Or I can decide to build. They've already given you an expedited process, in theory, right? It doesn't look like it's that expedited, but let's just, in theory, it's meant to be. They already give you an expedited process. So if you can expedite and take advantage of that and increase the size of your house by 10%, right, which is what you can do, and sit with a permit set of plans, you should be in a stronger position, because even if you are going to sell, selling without a set of permits versus selling with a set of permits, there's a difference. It's a big difference in terms of the price as well that you can yield from, you know, a developer. And it's not necessarily just a developer that's going to be buying these lots, I don't think. I think it's other young professionals in LA that want to be in the Palisades. I don't think it's as many developers as you think, at least yet, because some of the numbers don't pencil. We've looked at the lots, right? It's hard to make them pencil, you know, at $2 million a lot, some of them. I mean, some of them depends on where it is, but some of them don't pencil as developments. So it's either the price has to come down, or we've got to be further down the process, because I think that the lots become more valuable when houses around them have been rebuilt, mm-hmm. as opposed to like a nervousness right now. So, right. You know, and so you kind of had this lot pricing that was like, there was a kind of fire sale stuff at the start. You could argue some of those numbers, people actually got higher numbers, and now that those numbers are actually starting to come down in terms of what people are going to get for their lots, because as time goes on, maybe these lots become, you know, the market says this is what they're worth, and over time, if they don't sell, then ultimately what happens? Prices on them are going to start to come down. So,
what I think there's been some discussion around the need to really integrate environmental, you know, risk management, including dealing with, you know, waste management, hazardous waste, debris, contaminated debris and stuff. What are the less visible steps you would say, you know, that a developer must take before construction even begins? Well, especially, you know, in the, like, we're in a wild, well, I mean, probably we didn't even expect the Palisades to be a wildfire burn zone, but it is. So now I think there's a fear that probably everywhere is a potential, you know, risk area.
Yeah, I mean, it's all of LA is you know, potential risk zone. I think that there's a lot of change as it relates to protecting against that needs to happen. You know, it sounds like a crazy idea, but I think that we should have drones that are like big drones that are positioned on the mountaintops that sit there like 100% of the time, right? That like maybe they're in like a, you know, they're protected in a car with a cover on them, right? But in the event, because what's the problem with fire? The problem with fire is speed to instant, right? The fire happens, that is put out quickly. Because if it gets put out quickly, it ain't gonna spread. Right, so the second somebody knows about it, right, that there's a fire, if you could have these drones that could just go, they already have, you know, some amount of water in them, a capsule, and they can just go whoop, put the fire out, super easy way of dealing with it. It's not that far-fetched either, really. Think about it. Right? Look at all the drone technology that's happening right now, right? If they were strategically in the mountaintops, in the valley, across the top, between the valley and LA, they could move and be where they need to be very quickly. And then it's just a case of seeing, okay, there's a fire here. You know, a lot of the fire detection can be done via satellite, right? And then the drone goes, boom, puts it out. Not even in fire department involved anymore. You know, I think that there's a huge opportunity to bring technology like that into fire prevention, but nobody's doing it yet, right? So, but it's, that's the kind of planning that takes 10 years, but 10 years from now, we ain't even talking about wildfires anymore because these kind of unpiloted drones are protecting us against it. I don't think I fully answered your question. I kind of went on a tangent, but
I love the idea. I thought that's fantastic. I've never heard that idea before.
Simple. I think
come up with something new here, but I think I think that does it. You are answering it because it kind of is the question of, you know, how much is it that sort of the homeowners are gonna, like, back to this sort of self-sufficiency. How much the homeowners going to say, okay, it's my responsibility to do what I can to protect my home and property, and then how much is, you know, going to be handled by the community, by the civic infrastructure side.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, I spoke to a few people and they were like, I wish I didn't have good irrigation on my property because my house didn't burn down and every house around me burnt down, right? And they're like, now I'm sitting in a burn zone. My house, like, has got a bunch of fire damage, you know, and should have fully burnt down. And I'm battling with the insurance people because they're saying it's not a full rebuild, so to speak, right? And I'm kind of like, that's a tough one. Because, like, well, if everybody had the right irrigation, nobody's house would have burnt down, right? So to say...
You believe that that's a big factor?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure if the houses were correctly irrigated, in terms of the fire protection measures on the roofs, you know, of each house or property or the perimeter of each property, then they wouldn't have burnt down or had the ability to spread to further properties. Right. It's hard to say that because what we had was like a firestorm, right? And the amount of wind and that was coming was just crazy, but. But at the end of the day, like, I think that there's irrigation measures that would prevent it of spreading as much as it did. Mm. So, you know, there's ways. And I think that irrigation is something that, you know, should be standard on houses, right? You know, to make sure that in event of a fire, they can, those irrigation measures can be turned on and, you know, protect your house from a fire, you know?
So. A lot more fire suppressant systems, certainly.
Yeah.
So, Dan, I just have one last question for you, really. So, you know, we do have homeowners that are listening, you know, to our podcast that are tuning in. What sort of words of encouragement or vision would you share with them about the future of the Palisades neighborhood?
I would just say that, you know, there's a lot of hope. Right, amongst the community, like, and I know that everybody wants to get back as much as they can, and I think that I would just encourage them to take steps to be able to move forward as quickly as possible, right? So and try to rebuild their house bigger and better than it was before, right? And to try to, as hard as it is, to look at the opportunity, right? Look at the opportunity to improve, to make things better. And, you know, try to make sure that you're working with the right people to be able to do that in the most efficient way, right? So whether that be an architect, interior designer, or a contractor, or an AV consultant, whatever, just hire good people, hire professional people, and try to enjoy the process, right? Try to enjoy the process because I always say to clients that are building houses, when we go through that process with them, you know, I say to them, sure you want to build your own house? Sure you want to build your own house? Because if you don't love the process of rebuilding your own or building your own house, just go buy one, right? And I think that that's also true, although people with the power to set houses burned down, maybe they didn't want to go through that process, right? Maybe they don't like the construction process. But it can be an enjoyable process. It can really be fun, you know, whether that be choosing the finishes, designing the spaces. Like, it's such a fun process. I love it, right? I love that process. And so I think if you can try to find enjoyment in the process, right, and realize that the process is the destination, right? Mm-hmm. Like we all say in life. Ultimately, we want to get you home. But if it's going to take a while to get there, let's make sure that that process is fun. So us as builders, we try to make sure that that process is as fun as it can be. It's as open, best communication possibly. As many, try to avoid too many hidden issues or things coming up as much as we can. And just give somebody the most enjoyable process that they can have. I mean, construction is hard. It's really hard. And people always make mistakes. And there's always things that come up. But it's how you handle that, right? And how you communicate through those processes and make it enjoyable. That's the most important thing. And so that's what we want to try to do. Whether we're building for somebody's house that's burnt down the Palisades, or we're building for somebody that just wants to build the dream home that is house is not burnt down and they're building a new house, we want to try to just make sure the process is as fun and as enjoyable and as communicative as it can be. And you know, that's the most that we can hope for and they can hope for.
I love that. So. Love those words of positivity and optimism. Looking at it as almost like a blank canvas. And looking at some of these case study 2.0 designs and you know, it's a chance to build the home of your dreams again, and maybe something a little bit different than you had before. As you said, just enjoy the process. Well, thanks, Dan. I appreciate you joining us. So, Dan Green, everyone from Blackbriar Development, thanks ever so much for joining us today.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Take care.
Take care.
See ya.